want to, if I can read my writing, I took some notes when you were asking questions, and I wanted to kind of figure, get those comments in as we move into our second segment here. So we talked about the Bodhisattva and operating with compassion and power. And that has more to do with the understanding of the capacity and the capability to function in a certain office. And to have, even in the natural sense, we understand the functioning of an office or the role of an office. For instance, we talk about the president as a man or a woman, does not, that's not where the power lies. It lies in the power of the office. Are you with me? So it's the office of the president, as opposed to the man. And that's why we could have all kinds of men or women or people in that role, but it's only the value of the role is how we have agreed as to what the standard is and how to uphold the standard of the office. Also, the office itself is endowed with certain responsibilities. It's endowed with the certain rights or permissions to do certain things. For instance, to press that button, that nuclear button, it's while there is a man or a woman or a person, a human being of that can do that, it's actual, the power to do that isn't within themselves. It's within the power of the office. So you could make two very big distinctions between the person and the office. And when the checks and balances are truly there with operating as they should operate, with the responsibilities of those entrusted to uphold the authority given to the office, then you could see why the person then would be maybe the most powerful person in the country or the most powerful person in the world. But it doesn't have as much to do with the person as it has to do with the office. Is everybody with me? So when we say that we want to take up a certain office, hold a certain role or position within the world, within the society, within our community, in our relationship to one another, we have to fulfill the requirements of the office. Otherwise, if we act solely in our popularity or in our worldly skills, then we reduce the dignity. We can reduce the dignity or the quality of the office. So this power that I'm talking about goes along with the intention and the vow that we take up and that we agree to live. And so the Sangha, the Buddhist Sangha, is not exempt from this. We can see everywhere where people of stature, people of political power, people of spiritual or religious organizations have taken on a role that they're not capable, they're not qualified for, because they don't live the aspiration of the role. And so you see things happening that shouldn't happen, but they happen due to the frailty and the inability of the people who hold those offices to be true to the office. Mm. And this is not a thing that necessarily happens overnight. It's also why good people go bad, you know, because we don't fiercely protect the Dharma. We don't, the truth, we get stickily enamored, you know, with our teachers. And our teachers, with their station or their status or their role or their image in life, and it leads to all kinds of problems and downfalls. And why? Simply because it's not just about cultivating. I can do a great job. We started a, you know, I just use worldly examples because my Buddha master says all worldly Dharma is Buddha Dharma. I just love my teacher because he can just say something. I think that's so wrong. That's just so wrong. I can give him a scripture and verse right out of the Majjhima Nikaya. That's so wrong. But then when I sit and I think about it, then I'm able to slice and dice it to fit this particular situation. And although it appears to be contrary in general, in specifics, it fits, you see. But that's like the discretion and the discernment that we develop through prajna, not necessarily through information, although information is definitely necessary, but through the processes of contemplation and reflection and cultivation. So that kind of deep insight, the kind of deep prajna comes about through the hearing it, first of all, contemplating it, reflecting upon it, like where does that fit in my, where do I fit into that if I hold that to be true and establish that as a standard, and to like just keep pinging it, just keep touching that door, not with like trying to knock the door down, but just keep touching it and seeing like, where am I fitting with this? How is this, you know, landing on me? And I have a friend, my Kapya, Kay, and we've been together now for 20 some years, like 22 years. And in zodiac signs, I'm a tiger. And she's an ox. But this is what I know about ox and tiger. The tiger could be more ferocious, right? The tiger can have a lot of energy for attacking, you know. So people think, oh, well, then you'd always win because you're the tiger and she's the ox. But no, all you got to do is get it into get maneuvered into a closed space. All the ox has to do is lean on that tiger, and it'll wear that tiger out, you know. And so that's something that you come to know. So I know that whenever Kay and I have, you know, like a difference of view and difference of opinion, I know, oh, I shouldn't say this. I have to whisper because she's right out there. I know how I have to work with her, you know, if I'm trying to get something accomplished and she has a different view about it. And maybe, and when I don't, like, go with, like, because I'm the one, I got all the, you know, I can patch something up to meet a Dominic standard because it's all in my head, you know. So if it's all in my head and I want it, I know how to package it together really good. And so I have to work on not doing that. And I do work on it mostly, but I just, to be honest with you, sometimes if I think that this is really what I should do, I have to figure out how to present it to her in a way that she can come around. And I can't like just charge and say, you know, this is it because bam, 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 bam. You know, I have to circle around a few times. And because there is a stubbornness that will just wear me. I just get too tired. You know, if we talk about something, let's talk about it quickly and let's execute. You know, I'm not one who like thinks and thinks and thinks and thinks about it. You know, it reminds me of the people in church, and they were always like, you know, how they love the pastor, and then they come and ask your advice, and then you're giving them, well, let me pray over. You should have prayed over before you wait till my time. You know, like that. So that's how I think, and she's very methodical, and that's not a bad thing for me, you know, to have somebody in my life who's as methodical as I am, spontaneous, you know. So it makes for a good combination. But I have to recognize that quality, you know, and then I have to see it as a quality, and I also have to learn how to work with it, to get some things accomplished. And that's the wisdom that I'm talking about. So there's a sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, Sutta 128. You know what? Why don't we just stop for a minute? I don't know where you were for lunch. I'd like to just take a minute for us to come and be fully here, because this is intense work. I'm giving y'all like a big download today, you know, and you can, I think they're recording it, and you can play it back and you can unpack it, you know, bit by bit, and take chunks that you want and leave the other ones for another time, or maybe even for never for you. But I like to kind of use the time to drop some things in that may not be in your normal study routines and so forth, to give you a more fuller flavor of the Dhamma that the Buddha taught, as opposed to how it has migrated and pieces pulled out for emphasis and so forth over 2,500 years. Yeah. So let's just stop for a quick second and just take that. Not a quick breath, not a slow breath, just a normal inhalation and exhalation. Noticing as soon as the inhalation is complete, it's gone, and the exhalation begins. And one is dependent upon another. You can't have one without the other. And to restrict or restrain one is to constrict or restrain the other. And either one or the other, the inhalation or the exhalation, will experience a trauma outside of its normal abiding. If we use too much, effort or interest in elongating or cutting short the inhalation or the exhalation. And we see it's not just a matter of thinking about this is an in-breath, this is an out-breath, this is a long breath, or this is a short breath. Even though the suttas speak of it in that way, breathing in, we know this is a long breath. Breathing out, we know this is a short breath. The knowing is not in the mental ascent. The knowing is in simply the experience of the life-giving quality of each breath. And so the direct experience of breathing is 100% entirely different than just thinking about breathing. And yet, when we just rest in the rhythm of the natural inflow and the outflow, the whole body harmonizes. All the ingredients, components then make up the mind body fall into sync. And as one touches this state, the self-awareness begins also to subside, and there's just that touching a suchness or no-thingness, because we're not trying to focus on any particular thing. And then one might ask, where is the mind? We find that it's neither within us or outside of us. The unadulterated mind just is. And then we realize that most of our striving takes us further away from experiencing the true nature of things. And our striving is attached to a definite conclusion based on something we may already know. but not having a fullness of you. For the journeyer, it's the leaves and the forest that bring us comfort. Not just the leaves in our hand. You know that story, right? When the Buddha's talking to his disciples, he said, "What do you think is the more, the leaves in my hand or the leaves in the forest?" And they said, "Well, of course the leaves in the forest." He said, "Well, leaves in my hand, that's what I'm teaching you compared to the leaves in the forest. That's what I know." You know? And so we have a tendency to build an edifice around the leaves in our hand when we need to be more open to the leaves in the forest. And why do we tighten up around that? Because once you know something, that's part of our status building. That's part of our status building skill set, you know? And that's why we defend what we know so tenaciously, because we attach it to ourselves and to our sense of worth and value. So we're always using stuff, but we don't think we're users, do we? No, we don't. We just think we're good Dharma students, you know? We like just drop that into the case of fearlessly defend the Dharma that you know. But mostly that's like propping ourselves up, defending our brand of something, you know. But this was just the truth in the beginning. Before it started getting broken out due to our grasping and our craving and our blemishes, our imperfections, and became distradition and that sect, you know, and who's your teacher? All of that stuff, all up in there, you know. Don't waste your time in that, because that's not where liberation is going to be found. But we need to keep our eye on the prize in Sutta number 128. The Buddha was staying at a campground, and argument kind of broke out between two senior teachers. Well, actually, someone had witnessed a senior teacher do something or not do something. And the other teacher's student saw it and started talking about him, passing, you know, rumors. Like, instead of just respecting him as equally as he respected his teacher, and it had to do with, you know, using a urine bucket and then not cleaning the bucket, this old teacher. And instead of him saying, "Well, if that had been my teacher and in his age, he made a mess, I just clean it up, you know. I wouldn't go tell everybody and create animosity, you know, because an argument arose between the two teachers' students." That's how stuff gets started, you know, because we can't like just be faithful around something and clear it up. Or, and again, we have to use discretion around doing that. We're in a kind of climate now where everything is to be exposed. It's just like a car that has a, I had a broken motor mount in one of my cars. So when you press on the gas and then you let up, you know, it lifts the motor up of the, I guess the propulsion or whatever makes the car, you know, that gives power and motion to the car. So the motor lifts and it doesn't come like right down. It's like kind of gets stuck out there. So the car would be going fast with my foot off the gas, because the mount that holds the motor securely in place was broken. And I don't know what was wrong with the car, but the car wouldn't stop. You know, I'd have to like tap the brake a few times, or sometimes I had to tap the gas to try to charge and then release to get it to drop down. And I took it to the shop and I said, something's wrong with this car. The motor, the car won't stop. And he said, it's a broken motor mount. That's all. And I think sometimes that we're in that kind of broken condition as a society right now. And it can be very dangerous. We need to get that mount fixed. We can't say everything we want to say. We can't do everything we want to do. And although we may want certain freedoms and certain liberties, you know, we can't have everything now because we want it now. There has to be the groundwork and the building and the individual heart work to create the kind of world we want to live in. We can't just make laws. I love in the Tao Te Ching says that when the is lost, then we have morality, the being virtue. When virtue is lost, then we have morality. When morality is lost, then we establish laws. You know? And then when laws are lost, then it just goes down until the society disintegrates. You know, and it's the same way with the Dhamma. That's why the Buddha talks about virtue. And virtue is its own self-driver. Virtue gives us our reason for living, our true reason for walking things out. But we don't want too much talk about people telling us how we should be, what we should do, what's good, what's not good. And we don't hear too much of that. After all, we are grown, you know. And we worry about, you know, any kind of organized attempt, you know, because that might sound too much like, all right, Linda, might sound too much like a country or government trying to control us. You know, like I can think for myself. You know, I can wear my mask or not wear my mask, you know, and we can get into these kinds of places where our very freedoms set us up for destruction. You know, so we have to think clearly about this, and we have to use whatever we consider our good guide, you know, to help us in how to maintain a governor, a inner control, a balance around things. So in this sutta, the Buddha, they were arguing, and you know, one is saying like, you disrespected my teacher, and you this and you that, and the Buddha said, brothers, don't fight. And they said to the Buddha, you're a visitor in our camp right here. We got this. And so he went on back in his kuti. And then they continued their antagonism against each other. He came back the second time. He said, brother, we should not act like this. And again, they said to him, it'll be okay. This is our affair. You know, you're visiting. And then it was a third time, and he went to them the third time. And they said, "We've asked you to, like, basically mind your business." He said, "No problem." He got his bowl and his robe, and he left that community. He walked down the road, and there was another group in the forest. I forget whose forest it was, but and someone was keeping watch while they meditated. And he started going in, and the guy said, sir, don't go in there, because the Buddha's disciples, Siddhartha's disciples are in there meditating, and they are good men, you know, and don't disturb them." And, but Anuruddha heard him, and he said, "Oh, let him in. That is our teacher. Let him in." And he came in. And after they shared pleasantries, he says, I hope things are going well for you." And they said, "Yeah, things are going good for us." He said, "I hope you're blending like milk and water." He said, "Yes, we are blending like milk and water." He said, "Well, tell me, how do you do that?" He said, they said, "Well, we think about what a boon it is, what a pleasure it is for us to dwell together here. And so when I want to do something, I think, why should I do what I want to do? Why not do what my good brethren here in the Dharma wants to do?" He said, "And then I do that. I look to see what it is that he wants to do, and I do that with him." And now I can just tell you, from living in a monastery, that's a lot. It's saying a lot. You know, the only difference between monastery and living in the lay life in regard to relationships is that at the end of the day, you don't have to go home with people you don't want to be with. But in a monastery, we have no choice. You know, we didn't pick each other. We didn't choose to be together, you know. And so we just have to learn how to get along with people, or learn something about ourselves in the process of getting along or not getting along with others. And we put the community life, we learn how to put the community life above our individual needs. Now, that's where it's a good training, because like I say, we didn't pick each other personally. And so he said, "Well, that's good. He said, and more than that, he said, "When something has to be done, if we see a brother struggling," he says, "he doesn't have to call and say, 'John, can you help me?' He said, we can go, we'll just go and we'll pick up the other end of that and help him carry where it's got to go and sit it down. And then we walk away and go back and do whatever we were doing. He doesn't have to say, 'John, can you come help me?' He doesn't have to say, 'John, thank you for helping me.'" Now, some of us will do just about anything, but you got better make sure that you give us the proper thanks for it. You know, got to have the proper recognition. And it's these places that he asks us to look, because that's where the refining comes in. And it's also where the stainless vision arises. And so the Buddha said, "Well, that's really good." He said, "And like, how's your meditation going then?" He said, "Oh," they said, "our meditation is going good." And I know y'all might not believe me, so I'm just going to read this one little passage so y'all can't say I'm making stuff up. He said, "And this is, whoever notices that the pots of water for drinking and washing or the latrine needs to be taken care of, takes care of it. If they're too heavy, he calls someone else, or by signal or the hand, or if we observe, we quickly move and join hands. Because of this work, we don't have to have a whole lot of conversation around everything. But every few days we get together and we talk about the Dharma all night." And see, I was a Pentecostal, and if it was all night, it was all right. But when I got to Buddha land, y'all let me know pretty quickly, like, we like 45 minutes That's it. If you can't cover it in 45 minutes, it's too much. You know, some even 30 minutes. But some of this takes a lot to unravel and a lot to uncover, and giving of analogies so that one sees without any sense of shame, and one understands without any sense of blame. Like, you know, they just start to see how this is everywhere in nature, you know, and one becomes more at ease in their, you know, as they walk the path, and they also become more understanding and accommodating. We learn to overlook a slight and tolerate a fault. That's what I mean. So we're good sometimes with the Dhamma, so long as you don't slight us, so long, you know, as I don't see a fault. Or sometimes if you didn't thank me, you didn't give me my props, you know, but those are the places where our growth occurs, you see. And so the Buddha says, well, this is good, good Anuruddha, but let me ask you this, while you abide thus diligent, ardent, and resolute, because that's what he said, we abide diligent, ardent, and resolute. He said, like, well, how do you do that? He didn't say, oh, because we're reciting the Dhamma to each other, or because we're sitting here in meditation. He said, no, when I see something needs to be done, I get up and do it. When I see somebody needs help, I help them. When I knew, you know, it was all action, all action, all action. We have all these sitting Buddhas. We need to have some walking Buddhas. We got some sitting ones, and we got some standing ones. But we need to have him with one knee up, like he's in motion. You know, because we think that's the whole big thing, but it's the walking out of this really is where the power is. Therefore, that's where the victory is. And so he says, have you attained? But while you abide thus diligent, ardent, and resolute, have you attained any superhuman states, a distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones? Noble of the Buddhas, the noble ones. It says, Venerable Sir, as we abide here, diligent, ardent, and resolute, we perceive both light and a vision of forms, speaking of in their meditation. But soon after, the light and the vision of forms disappear, but we have not discovered the reason for that. He said, the Buddha said, you should discover the reason for that, Anuruddha. He said, before my awakening, while I was still only an unenlightened bodhisattva, I too perceived both light and a vision of forms. And soon after, the light and the vision of forms would disappear. And I thought, what is the cause and condition why the light and the vision of forms have disappeared? And then I considered thus, doubt arose within me. And because of the doubt, my concentration fell away. And when the concentration fell away, the lights and the vision of forms disappeared. As I shall so act that doubt does not arise in me again. Said in Anuruddha, while I was abiding diligent ardent, I perceived light and vision. You know how it's very repetitious. It said, and he said, now at this time, why did it in my meditation? And he said, then I considered thus, inattention arose in me. And because of inattention, my concentration fell away. He said, and then another time, sloth and torpor arose. And because of that, my concentration fell away and the light and vision of forms disappeared. And so I shall act that neither doubt nor inattention nor sloth and torpor will arise in me again. But he had to recognize it. He had to ponder on it. He had to contemplate. He had to look deeply to get to uncover, to discover what was happening inside of him, specifically in that sitting. What happened right here? And then he went on and he talked about other times, you know. And there was another time it was elation. And because of elation, everything fell away. Another time it was inertia arose. Another time excess energy arose. And another time deficiency of energy arose. It's a kind of long chapter. It's called The Imperfections, this chapter 128. It's called The Imperfection. And he said, then another time longing arose in me. So you see, he began to teach himself bit by bit through observation of what exactly was going on inside of him. How exactly was he showing up in the moment? What else was arising and distorting or disturbing or hindering the clarity in the moment? He just didn't watch things arise, you know, abide and go away. He considered how they affect and cause a short-sightedness or to keep him from reaching his goal. He didn't say like things are just like how they are. He looked to see how was it, and if it wasn't good enough, what was in the way? What could make it better? I mean, this doesn't sound like someone who just sits there and folds their hands and closes their eyes and waits for the bell ringer to ring the bell in 30 minutes. There was something going on. He was working in there, but with the right kind of effort, the right kind of looking. That's a great, great suitor if you want to make progress. It tells you how to look, not necessarily what to look at, because that's going to be individual, but he tells us how we should be efforting, you see. And then he goes on to about 21 different things. Deficiency of energy, longing, perception of diversity, all of these things. And he said, and I called them, he said, imperfections of the mind. It's like the red dye number 2 Kool-Aid in the clear glass of water. He said, but once I realized what the cause and condition was for this particular not meeting or reaching my goal, he said that he realized that when his concentration is limited, then his vision is limited. And with limited vision, he perceived limited light. And with limited light, and light speaks of understanding, perceiving something, being able to penetrate dullness or confusion or, and he said, and when the concentration was strong and immeasurable, then my vision was immeasurable. So it's not like we add things on. Everything is already there. It's just like, how far can you peer into the darkness, the delusion? It's all right there all the time. My teacher painted a painting. I went to his museum when I was out in California a couple of weeks ago. And you can't touch any of those paintings, right? You know, they're worth millions of dollars. But he has one. He says, go ahead, put your hand in that painting. And when you reach to touch it, and you think you're touching the painting, and yet you could do like this, and you're not even close to the canvas, you know, and it's so strange. Then you go a little further, and it's almost like viscerally, you can feel your hand going into the painting, and you can do this again, and you haven't touched the canvas yet. By the time you touch the canvas, your mind is confused, you know, because you're looking and you're perceiving something with your vision in the way you see, But the way this has been painted is so extraordinary. But the minute you experience that, something opens up in your mind and you understand this is also how I see the world, you know, and that it doesn't have to be exactly as I see it. And so it's like that. These exercises he takes us through is so that we can have a shift in consciousness. We can have a change in perception, because that's all that needs to change. Everything is like it is. It's just if we can have a shift. And so he said he would practice in the future in that way so that these obstacles don't continue to arise in this life. So now I want to shift a little bit to the things that we should do then. First is a well-rounded study. I know that, you know, Buddha is famous for the six this, the four that, the 18, the other, the, you know, and that's good. And we should know them, but not just to be able to rattle them off, because it's not really like the four noble truths. It's the four ennobling truths, you know, because actually that's a, it's not a noun, that word. It's something that helps us, that has the capacity to build something in us. So it's ennobling in that sense. And it's a very simple, like, you know, there is the truth of suffering. And suffering has a cause. There's a reason. There's a reason why, you know, whether it's apparent to us or not. And he said, but the good news, and they think like, oh, that's the, you know, this is the world of suffering. And Sam said, yeah, it is, until you enter another realm of consciousness, then it's not. That's why in the Mahayana, they say, if the Buddha encountered a mountain of swords and jumped on it, the swords would turn into flowers, you know, because of his own mind, not the external obstacle. Didn't mean that he now had no obstacles. He had plenty, mostly from within his own faction. Somebody always trying to take over. Somebody trying to kill him. His brother, David Datta, you know, Chanda, his charioteer, all the people who were the closest to him. You know, so don't think just because you're a Buddhist that everybody going to like you, that they're going to wish the best for you, or they're going to help you at what you initiate for good. Nah. It doesn't work like that. But one learns how to do what they can do and not be attached to that. So if it doesn't all work out, you know, then it's not like a reflection on you. You weren't good enough. You weren't, you know, worthy of it. If you know you did your best, your very best. If you were Jeff and when it happens, then, you know, except, you know, yeah, I didn't do my best. But when you have done your best, then one has can be at peace, but regardless of the outcome, whichever way something happens. And that's when you'll start to have confidence within yourself. And confidence within the Dharma in you, that's actually where the confidence comes from. Within yourself, you being the Dharma. The more Dharma there is in there, the less you there is in there. And then one starts to be confident in their walk, confident in their talk, assured in what they know from direct experience, and able to hold what they don't know with respect. And then they also offer that to others. If that was the case, you know, in spite of the fact that we live in a world where everybody has different minds and different bodies, Buddha said some worlds have same mind, same body. Some worlds have same mind, different body. Some worlds have different mind, same kind of bodies. He said, but we live in a world with different minds and different bodies. He said, how do you expect us to agree? So we won't always agree. It's not even to be expected. But yet and still, there is a way that we can live harmoniously with most people, not the least number, the greatest number of people, by how well we cultivate and develop ourselves. So it's more like we become the thermometer that sets the temperature in a room, as opposed to a barometer that measures the pressure. So this is our work. It's a noble endeavor, and we get free in the process. So one of the greatest trainings we can undergo is tolerating slights and overlooking faults, you know, because there we stop attaching so tightly to our views and to our opinions and to our rights. Yes, everybody should have rights, but he said, don't, you know, if you hammer that in, if you try to defend your rights in the not wise way, you will end up doing more harm than you do good. Because the way you go about securing your rights, the blowback is going to be the same way. So if you demanded them, it's going to come a boomerang demand on you to take them away. It's no way we can do certain things and not expect certain things to come back to us. You know, everybody's calling on their God is an awesome God. You know, that's looking after them and their people and their country. You know, all of that. Everybody knows that we are not alone. That there's some beings with certain capacities to support and reinforce us the same way as we are beings that have a capacity to support and reinforce other classifications of beings, like our pets. They're not humans. But here we are, and we have the capacity. Our monastery was built in, that building was built, compound was built in 1901. I got a place full of ghosts. You know, like we don't talk about that much unless somebody comes and the ghost has, you know, shown up. Or we have some children ghosts there who play marbles at night in a couple of the rooms, and the marbles are rolling on. You can say, like, I don't believe that, but I'm going to tell you what, the people who stay in those rooms, they don't care what you believe or not, you know, because they have this direct experience of it. But when we first got there, they were terrifying. I mean, we had poltergeists. I mean, not like just ghosts and seeing some apparitions, the kind that could like that, that could touch you, you know. But what we did was we used the loving kindness sutta on them. You know how the loving kindness, somebody mentioned it today, that one of the ways that they work at this three-time examination is or keeps unarisen, unwholesome thoughts from arising is by constantly filling their mind with metta. And the way that sutta came about was the Buddha left them in a forest, say, y'all stay here and meditate. I'm going someplace else. And I didn't always understand that when I first started as a nun and with a monastery. But after 20 years, I understand I need to go over there. You know, so I have a hermitage off the grounds now. But I understand these kinds of things. You can't like talk that out. You just got to live it out. So sometimes I need a space without all of the energies, even of everybody in the compound. And so so he went someplace else and they stayed there. And it says that the devas were happy that they were there. The devas who dwelled in the forest were happy that they were there. But after a while, the devas saw their lack of resolve. They weren't like the Buddha. The Buddha could have stayed there forever and they'd have been happy because his, like when I say aroma, I mean like his spirit, his heart, his whole being was at a certain level, but his disciples, not so much. And so they started thinking it's time for those boys to leave. You know, they're virtue just wasn't high enough. Their energy, their thought life wasn't high enough. And so then they started making their presence more known. And one day, one of the monks said, "Look, do you feel something bothering you?" And the other monk said, "Yeah, you too." He said, "Yeah," and they started talking, and everybody was feeling afraid. And they said, "We can't stay here. We have to go and go to the Buddha." And they went back to the Buddha and told him, "You know, that forest you left us in, it's haunted. It's full of ghosts." And Buddha said, "You need to go back. You need to go back there and bring your virtuousness of thought up to the level that you can abide in that place. And when you do, they'll be happy with you being there." That's what he did. He just sent them right on back. So sometimes we like just when we're hightailing it out of a space because it doesn't feel comfortable for us, we have to turn around and go back. There's nobody to make us go back. We decide. And it depends on what our goal and what our objective is. In this path, and that's how we find out what is path, what is really path. And path has to be walked upon, tread. So, in addition to studying, we have to introspect and, and be careful, and be patient when we are, just be patient under humiliating circumstances sometimes and cultivate yourself. And this means that we should practice, and I'm going to give you some points of cultivation now, and you can write them down if you want to, or you can Google them because they're there. Isn't it wonderful? I used to like have all of these references, but now I just tell people you can Google that, and it's magnificent what you can find in Google. The 10 wholesome courses of action, they're very simple. It's not killing. That means also not killing a person's reputation, not stealing. That means also not taking credit for something that you didn't do. We think stealing is like, I never steal. I never stole an article or object from somebody, but I have stolen the scene. I've stolen the moment. I've taken, making something about me in the moment and we weren't there for that purpose. It helps us to look deeper, more deeper than the word steal or the word kill. That's what I'm saying. It's not committing sensual misconduct. Sensual misconduct is more than sexual misconduct. It's like being careful how we see, being careful how we hear. Not always what we see or what we hear, but how we see, how we're looking at something. Being careful about what we are picking up in the conversation. How we see, hear, taste, touch, smell, and how we think, because he includes thinking as a sense factor. And that part of the mind, the conceptualizing, differentiating mind, as the causal factor for that, causal object for that. Not lying. Not engaging in idle chatter or gossip. Not speaking divisively. That's a hard one. Not speaking harshly. And that means that doesn't mean that there's never a time. We're just talking about in general. Just being kind in your speech, being considerate in your speech. But if you had a prize stallion and he's running for a cliff, you'd be hollering, "Hey, stop!" You wouldn't be saying, "Come back, come back." So sometimes she's somebody heading for a precipice. There were two sisters the other day, and they had like a little dispute because one sister wants the other sister to do something. And in times past, before they came to the monastery there with me, it was like the younger sister in the tradition they were in before, the younger sister serves the older sister. So I saw when they came in a dichotomy set up that I felt that wasn't healthy, you know, because the one who was senior, she just moved around like she had a little minion, you know, and the other one was trying very hard to be respectful and understand her stature as the younger sister. But I could feel the animosity underneath that smile and underneath that, okay, sister, you know, that really, okay, sister, you know, that, but it's there. So I needed to kind of work with that, you know? So we have to really sometimes say what needs to be said, or we take our part in establishing these kinds of roles and relationships and then blame the other person. You know? So when I was talking with her about it one day, she said, oh no, I take no offense. You know, I just don't pay her any mind. I said, sister, that is so not true. You need to confess for lying. I said, it's so obvious, you know, and that's why you do little things to irritate her, because that's the only way you feel like you can get back at her little deceitful things. I said, you see how that's causing you to just land in a garbage pail? And so I said, you know, you need to say what needs to be said. I mean, we have no children around here, and I'm definitely not babysitting. You know, so if you come here, you come here to do your own work. And I'm not going to be, walking in front of you and protecting you. No, you're going to have to learn to speak the truth. Speak it in love. If you're not that loving with it, just keep remembering your aspiration and get better and better at it. And you'll be okay in a little while, you know. And you also keep her from a great, great misstep, because these things can occur so subtly, you know, that you don't even realize it. And before you know it, you stand for something or somebody that you feel that they're totally not right. And you wonder how you got in this shape, you know, and it's all their fault, you know, because you're not going to take any blame for what you didn't do. Only going to blame somebody for what they did do. But we have errors of omission as well as commission. No, this is all worldly stuff, isn't it? This is all Buddha Dharma is worldly Dharma. We need to use it right here. It does take on a certain quality because we become purified in our thoughts and our speech and our actions. We become virtuous beings, you know, but not because we're trying to be righteous, but that kind of virtuous behavior, we have practiced it. We've become, we've applied diligence. And the reward of diligence is restraint. We apply restraint. And the reward of restraint is non-regret. And we have non-regret, which releases joy. You know, I mean, this goes somewhere. That's what I'm saying. It's a train that goes somewhere. Are you going? Are you on that train that's moving? So then, did I get through all 10 of them? No, of course, not being greedy or, you know, lustful, not being angry. And not being too lazy to apply our own mind, you know, to ponder on these things. And what you need to do depends on what your temperament is. So there are six basic kinds, they say. That's the hating, and the understanding. There's the greedy, and there's the faithful, and then there's the speculative and the delusional. The delusional, it may really have an impediment, karmic impediment, that they can't do anybody, just can't, just dull, just can't get things. You know, so you're not going to make them get it because the capacity is not there. So I like in the Bible says, tolerate the feeble-minded. And I'd go around like, he's feeble-minded, she's feeble-minded. You know, that's a, so I just started like trying to tolerate everybody, you know. And then that's when I stopped being mad with everybody. I just said, feeble-minded, you know. That's not the really the right way to do it, but it worked for me, you know. Just changing how I thought about them instead of like, that don't make sense. They know better than that. Like, I'm just not accepting that. I started just saying, tolerate the feeble-minded. And I found a strength that carried me over in relationships with a lot of people. So one of a, what was that temperament I was just talking about? Delusional. So one's not having the capacity, right? And the other delusional kind of temperament is one who's too lazy to do their own work. Too lazy to even think, where do you want to go tonight? Wherever you want to go. What do you want for dinner? Whatever you want for dinner. What do you want? You know, just, I don't even want to put the effort into thinking about it. Just whatever you like. And that can get to be a very destructive and limiting habit, you know. Then we stop speaking up. We stop telling, you know, sharing our truth. I won't say telling our truth, but we stop sharing what's really in us. So in a way, we become dishonest and we become liars. And then we get mad like you clamping me down. You don't even think about me. Don't think how I feel. No, because you never say. My husband said to me, you know, I was like that with him. He said, listen. He said, and it was true, I had to admit. He said, I'm not a mind reader. If you want something, you just tell me. If I want to do it, if I can do it, I'll tell you. I will. He said, but I'm not going to go around here trying to read your mind. And because we got an argument about never remembering what I like, you know, or to get me my certain kind of flowers and stuff like that. And he said, I'm not taking that on. You know, I said, well, if I have to tell you, then, you know, what is the good of it? He said, because I am not a mind reader. And so I said, okay, feeble-minded. And I stopped being mad with him. Yeah. By the time I walked out of that relationship to be a nun at 28 years, I was rethinking, like, am I sure this is what I'm supposed to do? Because I'm like real comfortable now. I'm real comfortable. I've been in this 28 years. I know what it is through and through. I have everything I want. The man, and this is about the thing about men and women. Women start seeing that clock wind down in their 50s or so. They say, this is my last opportunity. And they will step in a minute. But by the time the men get 50, they're ready to settle down. The woman said, go at it. And the women will leave. And so, you know, I look at these differences, and it's really true. And so you see all these hurting men, and after they done hurt somebody for 20 or 30 or 40 years, I'm like, that's okay, you get over it. You know, you just work it off your karma right now. You'll be okay after a while. So there's a way you can hold these mistakes that we make in life, you know. We don't have to hold them in a harsh, vindictive way. And pain ourselves over and over and over over things that other people have done to us, over things that we fail to do, you know, to protect ourselves. You see, it's time to let go of all of that. That's not even important. That's this worldly. But he says there is another world right here that we can enter into. Okay, so that's the 10 characteristics or the 10 wholesome courses of action. Of course, practicing the 4 limitless states of mind, and my, which of course is loving kindness. That loving kindness is real simple. It's just loving being kind. You know, some people, they just don't even like being kind. They just, no, but it's about, you have to love being kind. Love being kind. It's not always this kissy face kind of sweet talk and the smile. And it's not all of that, but it's really grokking with a person, really being there with my teacher. Bernie would call it grokking, you know, really being there with them, being genuine, being honest, but don't be brutal in your, brutally honest. There was this movement out maybe 20 years ago, radical honesty, you know, but it became a platform due to people's ignorance and not readiness, became a platform for abuse, honestly, that being radically honest kind of thing, you know. And that's why we have to work with these Brahma Viharas. You know, the Brahma Viharas is raising one's own mind state up to the state of holy beings, how virtuous beings think. That's all. And one is that they love being kind. Loving being kind. He said, but when you practice loving kindness, you know, then hatred will be abandoned in you. So if you find that you have a hating personality, I'm going to get back to what that is in a minute. That's the way to uproot it. He said, and when your loving kindness becomes filled, it's like filling a glass of water till it's topped off and it starts to spill over. Then that's when you can take up compassion. Some people trying to take up compassion and practice compassion, and they don't even like being kind. You know, but when that's full, it flows over into a compassionate nature, heartful, tolerant, gentle, understanding, long suffering, even. And so when that's done, then cruelty, the Buddha said, will be abandoned in you. One of my family members was killed by the Peep and Tom serial killer. And my family, they all wanted the death penalty for him. But they, you know, they wanted the death penalty, not to save, he was a fairly young guy, so he was going to live for 30 years, not to save 30 years of the taxpayers' money. This was purely personal. Eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. They wanted him to be executed. They didn't speak to me for a long time, like over a year, because I was the only family member that didn't ask for the death penalty. You know, I said that this was an individual who had a very sick mind. I wasn't a Buddhist at that time. I couldn't call it a karmic condition or know what it was or know how to even think along those lines. You know, I could think of it a lot of different ways now, but then all I was trying to do is have the love of Jesus in my heart. Yeah, he got to be locked up. You got to be put away somewhere where he can't hurt people. But in terms of wanting to kill him, no. And so so the cruelty, that's that when you have to say something or you start to say, well, you've offended me, you know, and this is how you've offended me, and you're starting to tell it, but then this little like cruel little thingy comes up in you, and you want to like really stick it to them, really hurt their feelings. So you say something that didn't need to be said, you know, because you just want a little extra oomph. That's that energy of cruelty. And he says that when you practice the loving kindness on the basis of an overflowing, compassion on the basis of an overflowing loving kindness, then cruelty in you will be abandoned. Mm-hmm. And when that love, that compassion fills to overflowing, that's when you'll have altruistic joy, a naturally arising joy in the successes of others. I even like to see my enemy win at whatever he deserves to win at, not win like triumph over me necessarily, unless he was better than me. If he's better than me, then he deserves to win. And even though I wish I had, I cannot hold, you know, any animosity towards him. So there is this joy in the successes of others. Now, some people, you need to hope they get better. I remember the newspaper showed up out at our door, the news cameras, and they wanted to interview me and Panyadipa. And they wanted to interview us because the city council or the commissioner's office, you know, they have the public, I don't know what they do in the city, but we're in rural North Carolina, and we have these commissioner meetings, and people can go up to the podium and say what they want to say about stuff that's happening. You know, the commissioners do what they want anyway, but they give us a chance to at least speak about it. And so somebody decided that they no longer wanted to end the opening prayer because everything opens with prayer. And we're in Billy Graham's country here, and they wanted to close it close it in Jesus' name. So now all of a sudden somebody comes here because we had like the progressive left coming in, you know, younger, wealthier, more political women coming in. And they were like, that's the first thing we're going to stop, you know, first of all, I'm Jewish, or because I'm, you know, whatever. They wanted to stop the in Jesus' name. I'm not a Christian or whatever. So now we've been here by this time a decade. News has never come to our door about anything, right? So now when this controversy starts, we weren't even at the town hall, but they come over to us to hear what we got to say about it. So me and Panyadipa said, I think it's good that they pray. I think they need to pray more, you know, because we could use some improvement in our behaviors around here. So I'm not opposing them praying in Jesus' name, Allah's name, Baha'u'llah, anybody that you think has a quality of character and being that can help you be a person, we need to have all of these. I know y'all don't want the Buddhist thing there, and that's all right, our feelings are not hurt. We ain't even trying to do that, you know. But if they, they just cut them cameras off and walked away. You know, they didn't even put that on the news because they didn't want to hear that. They were trying to stir up controversy, you see. But as you develop in your virtue, that's the platform for your wisdom growth, so that you know what's happening here, you know, because we could have been thinking, oh, here's our chance to like just say these great, great words, you know, can we all get along or something, whatever they're expecting from Buddhists. And then people will know we're here and then they'll come to our sangha and we'll grow. No, it wasn't any of that, you see. But you have the wisdom of what should be said, and to say that, whether it accidentally promotes you or whether it is actually like totally non-self-promoting, you can just speak the truth without any attachment to it. It's like that. So think about in your life, I'm giving you all these examples because it says, what is one of my masters said to me, what is the role of a master? You looking for a master. What's the role of a master to you? I didn't even have an answer, except for I knew I didn't know things. So I'm looking for, to me, a master is one who could like demonstrate that they know things and they could teach it to me. Because I wanted to know the things that ordinary people don't know. I want to think with a mind better than how we ordinarily think and make all these messes in the world. She said, no. She said, the only role of a master is to be a mirror for you, to show you that you too are a master. The only difference is I know I'm one and you don't know you are. And so she said, so then I began to understand something. But it's also why I tell so many stories, so that you can see yourself in something or see that you could see yourself if you didn't before, you know, because we all have these competencies if we were more confident that we actually had them and that it wasn't a figment of our imagination. So that was altruistic joy in the successes of others. Somebody can do something then to you one day, and the next day they can be in need and you will actually go to their rescue. Won't even take it personal. Won't even say, look at me, I am doing. You'll just like quietly do it or whatever, because that's what you're made of. That has nothing to do with them, you see. And so that's how you'll have altruistic joy, and that uproots jealousy and envy. So now we're getting rid of hate and aversion. We're getting rid of greed. We're getting rid of jealousy. We're getting rid of envy. You see, so we don't have to like try to stamp those things out like, oh, damn spot, out. We don't have to like beat ourselves up like that. When we're doing these things, it will begin to, those will begin to diminish those tendencies that we have. You know, we won't even like them after a while. We can smell them coming a mile away. There you go. You know, you can just speak to yourself. Nobody has to know. Just speak to yourself. Then you know that wasn't right. You know you didn't have a right motive when you said that. It's like, I sure did. I'm so sorry. You know, and who are you sorry to? To that you betrayed your own vow to yourself, you see. That's all. And then fix it with yourself. Fix it. And try harder next time. That's it. And then when that's topped off, when that's reached this fullness and it flows over, that altruistic joy, we call it equanimity. You know, and that's like the difference between when one is detached. You know, detached has a certain kind of coldness to it. It's like a cutting off, like a slicing, you know. But when one, but he doesn't mean it in that way. The Buddha doesn't mean it in that cut off kind of way. It means like you can be fully there and it has nothing in you, or you have nothing in it. That's why you can be fully there, because you're not wrapped up in it, attached to it, tied up in it, need something from it, you know? Then you could just be there. You could just be there and be free. You know, it's a, I was talking with a PLC group one time. Wasn't yours. It was another PLC group. And, at this retreat, there were 99 people of color at the retreat. I'll never forget. That's why I know the number. It was 99. And we were doing some filming for something, and we had a white videographer. They were they started passing me notes. They didn't feel that comfortable with a white person in the room. I'm like, listen, I just read it straight out. I said, listen, if 99 of you all and one, and y'all scared of one white person, I don't even know what to say. I think we need to like just disband this whole retreat and forget about this. We got other fish to fry, you know, and I was serious about that too. You know, I'm like, don't buy into some kind of story about impotence and weakness. I mean, I don't want to hear that. You know, and they got upset with me too, but I just kept right on. I said, that's all right. Like what the Dharma I'm going to share today, it goes for black or white, okay? It goes for chick or child. It goes for male or female. It's like we're all on one level right here today. And that's, I'm not a black Dharma teacher. I'm a Dharma teacher. And that was it. And I went off and it did upset like maybe, I don't know, maybe five or six people. No, I know that certainly two or three of them left. You know, and that was okay, you know, because I was there for the Dharma. The Dharma that liberates and sets you free. Whatever you think you're bound by, whoever you think you're bound by, you know, the Dharma teaches us something else. And we find that we can be really responsible for ourselves. Therefore, we can be responsive in every situation. Now, that's real power. That's something that you give me through a law, a rule, or edict, or whatever, you know. And so, so my Buddha master calls it boundless generosity. So because there was the loving kindness, there was the compassion building up, there's the altruistic joy, the joy in the successes for others, and all of this is a more and a more giving, allowing of yourself. until you just become vast and boundless and empty. And that is what equanimity really is. So find the words that mean something to you and use those words. Yeah. And you will enter into the words that you actually understand. Okay, I think it's, how much more time do we have? All this time changing. Give me in hours and minutes.
I think we have about 1 hour and 50 minutes. So almost 2 hours.
Almost 2 hours. Okay. Okay, good. So when I'm starting to get like this, if you could like Merlin, and let me know about my time, because like I say, I was Pentecostal all night, all right, you know, and I do have a lot more I want to share with you, but I'm almost feeling like, you know, it's only so much we can take in at one time, you know, and I don't want you to try to take in all of this, because I'm talking to different minds, people in all different spaces of their growth, their development, their understanding, their interest, and their willingness. All of that has to be considered, you know. So this part was on being able to truly and completely uproot your own defilements. And it's not like with a hoe where you might have something precious in the ground and accidentally chop it up. But it's like getting down there. You know how when they excavate at a pyramid site? No, they have brushes. And they sit there like brushing away on the sand. You know, they're not going there with no tools cutting and all of that, you know, because what's there is precious to them. And so they're brushing away to find the gems, to find the special things. And this is how we cultivate. And this helps us to become a person with a purified mind. The Buddha said, really, I just say three things: cut off all evil, stop doing evil, do good, and purify your mind. That's it. That's what I like about Ajahn Chah. You know, we have all of these vows that we take, 311, I think it is, for us as women, 200 and some for the monks. And Ajahn said that I just keep one rule. And they were, oh, you just keep one rule, but you're a monk. You just keep one rule. He said, I keep rule of my mind. That's it. You know, and that's how he taught his disciples. But some people are fixated on legalistically on the rule, the touch not, taste not, handle not. But it's not that. You won't touch certain things. You won't taste certain things. And you won't handle certain things as you build your virtue. So build your virtue and everything else will take care of itself. And to do that, you have to see the benefit. Okay, the path comes with benefits. There's benefits. We're not just doing it for the sake of goodness, but once we do it for goodness' sake, you know, because we see the benefit in our life. Mm. So some of us want to be bodhisattvas. You want to take up the bodhisattva path, and that is that's a step that has been taken after one has learned how to cultivate. You know, because if I haven't figured out how to get out the hole, you know, then I can't help you get out the hole. And sometimes just because I'm not out the hole, I might have cut grooves in the side of the wall where I can put my hands and my feet like rock climbing. you know, and I might be able to tie a rope around my waist and you tie one around yours. And then when I get up a few steps above you, you come up right behind in my path. So you can actually support other people and not wait until you attain full awakening for yourself. You know, so when he says, get yourself out the hole first, he means like have a plan, have a, you know, have something that you're following. And then you can say, follow me. You know, from what I have experienced already, I see light at the end of the tunnel. This is the way. This is the way out. You know, and just start going in that direction. And that's when you're at the place that you start considering others equally with yourself. You know, then you'll start to consider others, you know, even more highly than yourself. You start to feel like when I do something for them, even if it caused my having to take down something, I see a benefit in that. If I don't see a benefit in it, then I don't do it. I don't. You know, but if I saw a benefit, then I would do it. So taking in foster children, my kids would sometimes get upset. They'd say, Ma, you treat them better than you treat me. I said, not by long shot. You don't know, because I have raised you. I've given you self-esteem. I've given you, understand, these kids, they didn't have any of that. So they don't know how to act, you know? They're suffering very deep wounds and deep pains that you can't even imagine. So what if I give them a little extra cake? What if I, you know, like overlook some little behavior that they have? I'm going to deal with it in the right time. But if I do it right now, they're just going to be rejecting and pushing away. And it's just like every other place I've been and blah, blah, blah. I said, give me time to work with them. And you'll see. I mean, like, you got to hang with them because they're part of the household kids. I mean, like, you want that? You know, give me a space to help them find their better self. You know, it'll go easier on you. You know, they'll think you're their friend. And so that's how we have to work this thing, you know. And as we start doing that, and there's a satisfaction because we're moving more towards our intrinsic nature. You know, that's why there comes a satisfaction in it. It's like, this feels more like right. You know, this feels more like right. And when you're tired, it gives you so much energy. You could be tired as a dog, you know, and then somebody call and need something, and you forget your tiredness. It's just like Pavlov's dog, you know, and they trained them to salivate when the food was coming. And after a while, they didn't even give them no food. They just rang the bell, and the dog would go, and sometimes I've done things and it was so hard. It was so hard. It's like, I'm not doing this anymore. Tomorrow I get a call. I got to be right there. You know, the mind talking to me in one way, but conditioned in another way. I'm not talking like working yourself to the bone until you're so exhausted because you've given everything to everybody. But I'm talking about the kind of giving that's rooted in a certain accomplishment that has a well that doesn't run dry. In the 80s, 70s, I think. In the 70s, I was working with Mitch Snyder, and he was the one who brought the homeless issue, pushed it to a forefront where something had to be done. And I'm living to tell that story about it. I'm living 70, 80, 90, 30 so years later, you know. But where is he? He's 6 feet under. Because no matter what he saw, he couldn't see any progress being made. First thing they did, they gave us this huge government building on 2nd and D, Northwest in downtown D.C., and it was the first thing anything like this had happened, you know. And about, I think maybe 1 year after we got that building, he hung himself in the basement because all he could see was what else needed to be done. He couldn't see what was being done, you see. So we have to watch how we see, and we have to watch where our self ambition gets in there, because that was not useful. It wasn't beneficial. A great light went out of the world because he put himself too much in it. So there comes a place that if you follow this path correctly and you watch out for the hills and the curves, you'll find that you can do without doing, without any sense of I am doing. And so your energy is not depleted and nothing goes undone. And so sometimes, yes, we can be fully in the heart space, but there's preparation that has to be done to be in the kind of heart space that won't completely wipe you out. A lot of people come to me and they say, I'm done. I'm so tired. I have nothing else to give. I said, well, you might be getting into a place that you're ready to serve now. Because it was all when we had so much of self that we were given. That's what kills us. That's what wears us out. So when we talk about giving ourselves to others, giving ourselves away, putting ourselves on the front line for service, it's an even quicker path, you know, to awakening. We start to know intuitively what to do and how to do, you know. We bypass a whole lot of the study. We find out, like, when we read something, oh, I know that. You know, it's like, just like I thought. You know, it's like, because it's in the doing of it that the truth of something becomes known. And where you stand in relationship to that. Just like an intimacy. That's what I mean. People tell me, oh, I know your husband. You're like, you don't know him like I know him. You know, because I'm there with him. I see all of it. I feel all of it. I know all of it. You just know him from how you see him presenting himself to you in the world. You know, sometimes it's good and sometimes it ain't as bad as it looks. You know, but I know all of it. So let us not be afraid of the direct experience of this walk. We're not going to find, it's good for us to sit on our pillow and meditate, but I can tell you that was not the greatest part of the work. That was an important part of the work. But you know, I can sit there for an hour every day with a dull mind and get up and think I've done my job, what's required of me, you know, or I can go to a retreat to check out from the world, you know, and I can make good progress because nothing's bothering me right here, you know, and I go back home and I'm back in that same old thing again and I'm like I was before, you know, and after a while, a week of it turns into a month of it, turns into a year of it, turns into a decade of it, turns into 2-3 decades and we still crazy. No, and don't understand how that came about because we are so intense, so putting forth our effort. But it's like knowing, like when the plumber person had a leak and he called a plumber, and the plumber was there for just a few minutes and gave him a bill for $1,000. And he said, $1,000? You weren't here that long. What did you do? I need an itemized bill. He wrote, for tapping, $1. For knowing where to tap, $999. So it's like that. We have to know where to tap. And that's the difference. Maybe everything you're doing is right and it's good. But maybe there's just one more thing you need to do. Maybe you need to put the level on that pipe so to make sure you got a downflow so you don't get the stuff stopped up. Maybe you don't know what it is, but you try this and you maybe implement that. You look at something really contemplating, you know. and recognizing that our surrender is not a self-defeating thing, but our humility, you know, has its advantages. It makes us not get too embroiled in things. Keeps life uncomplicated and less sticky. Makes it easier for us to let things go out of our life or move around without sucking away all of our energy. We find that we, you know, tenaciously clinging to something because it sort of like represents us. And then when it finally gets wrenched from our hands, like we realize in 2 weeks, we didn't really care about that much. Actually, I would have let it go before, except that I'd already said I want it. So now I can't say I don't, you know? So we find that we become concretized and rigid, and we can actually learn the freedom that comes in surrender, in giving up, in not clinging. We like that better. Yeah, but it means to really not cling. So we're going to go into meditation now. And we're going to have a song that takes us there. And I think we'll do, I lay it all down. Did I surrender? What is that? I have one that's about laying something down or surrender one.
I surrender.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Yes, let's do that. Now, when we think of surrendering all, I'm thinking of how we surrender, in what ways we surrender. One is in ascribing worth to things that are worthy of our admiration and our adoration. We don't have to take it back into some old ways that we looked at ascribing worth, but we shouldn't throw the baby out with the bathwater either. If something or someone is worthy, then we should give them, you know, to them what they have earned, what is due to them. So I'm very grateful to the Buddha, to the Bodhisattvas, and all the other spiritual teachers that I've had throughout my life. I didn't get wherever I am, however much that is or however little that is. I didn't do it by myself. And so I have gratitude for them, grateful for them. I'm also grateful for compassionate wisdom truth. There's a saying that wisdom cries in the street. And that means simply that we're like surrounded by wisdom. If we could just open our eyes and see. It's as present as the air that we breathe. But because of obscurations, we don't see it. So surrendering to this wisdom truth because we want to know more. And also the other way that we surrender is through our service, in service to others. And every time we offer someone a piece of ourselves, we are surrendering or shedding that I won't use the word ego, because I think ego in a psychological term can be a healthy thing. So I don't mean that. And I'm thinking about the self in the center like us sitting in the center of our world, and like everything revolves around us. We give up that notion of being at the center of everything. I'm at the center, my children are the next layer, you know, my loved ones are the next layer, and then my friends are the next layer, and then, you know, maybe people I know that I'm okay with are the next layer, then folks maybe I don't know, then my enemies and you know, like that. And just getting rid of that whole matrix, that whole example, no longer sitting at the center. But, you know, I can be fluid. Wherever the mind goes, that's where I can be. I don't have to sit at the center. I can get on the edge, learning how to walk on the edge, just to be whatever is needed to be. I can be a hairbrush if someone's hair is tangled. I can be a toothbrush if somebody needs to brush their teeth. No, I can be a dress if somebody needs a covering. We don't have to identify ourselves as anything except a present help in the time of need. Okay, thank you for coming back. And we're wrapping up in these 4 minutes, and it's really going to be close to that. I'd like to close out with sutta number 55. Sutta number 8 in the Majjhima Nikaya. And the name of the sutta is effacement. Effacement means the rubbing out of self, or maybe emptiness. And in this sutta, the Buddha talks about meditation. And he says, there are various views that arise in this world. Associated either with the doctrines of a self or with doctrines about the world. Now, does the abandoning and relinquishing of those views come about in a bhikkhu who is attending only to the beginning of his meditative training? And it said, Kunda, as to those various views that arise in the world, either with doctrines of a self or with doctrines about the world, if the object in relation to which those views arise, which they underlie, and which they are exercised upon, is seen as it actually is with proper wisdom, thus, this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself, then the abandoning and relinquishing of those views come about. So it says that the abandoning of the views that hold us to clinging and craving and suffering and differentiating and, you know, all of our conceptual thinking that keeps us from bypassing the conceptual realm and entering into the prajna realm of pure wisdom are done through seeing as it actually is with proper wisdom. This is not mine. This I am not. This is not myself. And that's how the relinquishing of those views comes about. So in this sutta, he talks about the 8 attainments. And in these 8 attainments, they're all meditative attainments, starting with the first jhana all the way up to the fourth jhana and the 4 aspects of the fourth jhana, the formless jhanas. And so he said, one might think, in verse 10, one might think thus, when I attain these attainments in meditation, that I am abiding in effacement. He said, but these are called peaceful abidings in the Noble One's dispensation, the Noble One's discipline. But now, Kunda, here effacement should be practiced by you. And then he goes from verses 12 on up through verses 44. What effacement, how to rub out the self, should be practiced. He talked about entering into those meditative attainments, but he said he called them what? I just read it. Pleasant abidings.
Yes.
Right. He didn't call that practice. He called that pleasant abiding. So if that's the bulk of your practice, then you know, like you, like y'all, one, the Buddha's on a highway and you on the old road. You know how when they build a new highway, new six-lane highway, and then they have the old single lane and they call that old something, you know, so they keep that name. But he says, that's not what I call practice. He said, this is how non-self or the rubbing out of self or entering into emptiness should be practiced by you. Others will be cruel. We will not be cruel. Others will kill living beings. We will not. Others will speak maliciously or speak falsehood, and we shall abstain from that. Others will be covetous or have ill will. We will not. Others be a wrong view. We'll be a right view. Others will be a wrong intention. We'll be a right intention. It goes through all of these. Look it up and read it for yourself. Sutta number 8. Others will gradually others will be overcome by sloth and torpor, but we shall be free from sloth and torpor here. Others will be angry. We shall not be angry. Others will be insolent. We shall not be insolent. Others will be fraudulent. We will not deceitful. We won't obstinate, not us arrogant. Mm-mm. Others will be difficult to admonish. We'll be easy to admonish. This is how effacement should be practiced by us. And it goes on to, I'm on the 35th banana, it goes on to 44. So it goes on to 9 others. Others will be of little learning, will be of great learning. Others will have no fear of wrongdoing. We should be afraid of wrongdoing. Others will be faithless. We should be faithful. Others will be negligent. We shall be diligent here. Others will lack wisdom. We will possess wisdom here. Others will adhere to their own views, hold on to them tenaciously, and relinquish them with difficulty. We shall not adhere to our own views or hold on to them tenaciously, but shall relinquish them easily. This is effacement should be practiced thus. And then he goes on and talks about how to do that. To the one who is restless, he has non-restlessness by which to avoid it or abandon it. To the one given to the wrong knowledge, he has right knowledge by which to abandon and avoid it. To the one who has contempt, he has non-contempt also by which to abandon and avoid contempt. To one given to arrogance, he has non-arrogance by which to abandon it. So he's saying when we're looking for, he's letting us know that we already have what we need. We need to abandon the unwholesome mental states and the unwholesome thoughts and speech and action. We have the opposite of what we're thinking if it doesn't line up with the Buddha's teachings on what constitutes freedom and what constitutes liberty. I mean, like if you found freedom and liberty, then just disregard everything I'm saying. But if you have not, then he says, give this a try. I'm giving you everything you need to avoid it. And, you know, for instance, he says, if you have hate, he doesn't say you have love by which to abandon him, because then you're like, I'm so confused, you know, but he said you have non-hate. So whatever thought you're thinking right now that you're classifying as hatred, what's the opposite of that? That's how you need to move your mind right now. And, you know, by recognizing that we could, if we were willing to, if we really wanted to, it's like, I don't want to hate you forever. I just want to hate you right now. You know, you deserve at least this much from me, you know, and I want to give you this much. That's just all the rest. Once I get out the gate, I can't get that horse back in the stable, you know. But so he's helping us to really see ourselves and not be fooled by the stories we tell ourselves about how impotent we are and how we can't do something. And I'm doing the best I can and I'm struggling and I'm this and that. He was like, oh, not really. you know, just look right here. What is the opposite of that thought you're thinking about her right now? Just like when I was thinking about that baker, you know, erasing my recipes and whew. And then I just thought, I just moved my mind to how I had seen him relate to his son so lovingly, so free, with abandonment, with full trust. And I said, that is a quality to be desired in him, you know, that he is portraying. And once I moved my mind to that, everything else that I was trying to not think that was dastardly just dissolved. It just fell away because I moved my mind to something that was wholesome. And that's where we get a little caught. We get a little tripped up. Our willingness at that moment, or we'll feign confusion, or we'll, you know, or weakness or something. And he's letting us know, no, you really can do it. You really are strong. You really have it in you. If you have the Dhamma in you, that's your strength. You don't have to worry about trying to work in your own strength. Work in the strength of the Dhamma. That it's such a wonderful chapter, because at the end of it, he said, Kunda, there are just as there are unwholesome states that lead downward. He said, all wholesome states lead upward. To the one who is himself sinking in the mud, to think that he should be pulled out by another, it is not possible. One must pull oneself out of the mud. And so read that sutta if you get a chance, but you've had a long day. Just write it down and read it next week, okay? Give a minute for some of this to settle on you. But we don't live life topically, right? We like to learn topically, but we don't live life topically. Everything like just swirls around due to cause and condition. And so there's another way we have to learn as well, you know, so that as things swirl, we can know what to apply here and what to apply there. It's not an academic learning, but it's how to be with everything that's happening in our life, moment by moment. So I know this was a lot today. I thank you all so much. And I hope something landed for you. If they don't reach for anything, and just rest and let things arise. It will arise for you today, tomorrow, next week, next month. And you realize that you really did learn something and that you hid something in your heart. May you be well and happy and peaceful. May no harm come to you and no danger. May you always be able to meet the inevitable difficulties of life. See you tomorrow.